Elizabeth McQueen, and you are listening to This Song, the podcast where artists talk about the songs that formed and transformed them. This week on This Song, we'll be hearing a rerun of an interview we did with Tegan and Sarah, the Canadian twin sister pop duo. But before we get started, I wanted to let you know about a couple of cool things that you can help this podcast out with. The first is the Austin Chronicle's annual Best of Austin poll. It's happening right now, and you can vote through September 4th. And yes, This Song and KUTX, the radio station where we make this podcast, well, we would love your vote. And remember when we did a live taping of this podcast with Dessa at South by Southwest, like this past year? That was super fun, right? Well, we want to do it again. We've submitted our idea for a live taping of this podcast to the South by Southwest panel picker process, and we could use your vote. I'll post links to the Best of Austin poll and to our South by Southwest panel picker page, which I just like saying because of the alliteration, on the show notes page for this episode at kutx.org. And if you live in Austin, Texas, then I want to let you know about two cool events that I'll be part of this Sunday, August 19th. So at noon, I'll be interviewing Ethan Hawke and Ben Dickey at Waterloo Records. They're in town promoting a movie they made about the life of singer and songwriter Blaze Foley. Ben will be playing some songs. They'll be signing autographs. It should be awesome. You should come. And then I'll be heading over to the Scottish Rite Theater for a live show of my favorite kids podcast, Tumble. The show starts at 4, and if you have kids and or love science, you should come because Lindsay and Marshall, who make Tumble, are amazing. And my girls and I, well, we wrote a song using some of the music that Marshall wrote for the Sea Stars episode that they'll be talking about, so you definitely want to see that. Saul Paul will be playing. It's going to be a lot of fun. Okay, back to Tegan and Sarah. We ran this interview back in December of 2016. And why, might you ask, are we rerunning this episode now? Well, because I just spent a couple of weeks with my darling sister and her family, and I miss her. And hearing these two women who grew up together and who are a force for good in each other's lives and in the world, well, it just makes me happy. And it takes the edge off my missing. Next week, we'll have a new episode featuring Alex from Beach House. It's a really good one, by the way. You don't want to miss it. But now, let's listen to this interview with Tegan and Sarah.
Seventh grade. I'm just 12 years old, which sounds young for seventh grade, but I don't know. Do it differently in Canada. A guy named Jason Ng, who was older than us, he was this really cute skater guy that every girl liked. I was fascinated by him. I loved his clothes and his hair, and he was very, very cute guy. And he, I remember very clearly in the library, bringing over Smashing Pumpkins' Siamese Dream and telling me to listen to song 3. And I went home with a borrowed CD from Jason Ng, which was like very like, I was very cool.
And you were like,
always,
basically he was your boyfriend.
Yeah, basically he was my boyfriend. He basically gave me an engagement ring. And so my friends were very jealous, but he gave me the CD and I put on Today. And literally the first, whatever, 30 seconds where it's just the single note melody of the song, the main hook, I just was like, what is this? I just felt like I was hearing something completely new. And when the big crashing, you know, music comes in and starts, I just was like hooked already. And then it like, and then it quiets out sort of, and it drops into that verse, and Billy's voice starts. I became completely, completely obsessed. That record in particular, like Today, I became obsessed with. But then the entire album, I could sing every note, every melody. I could do all the guitar parts. I loved Today so much, but I mean, the Pumpkins became like my band. I had, my entire room was covered from floor to ceiling. I was so obsessed with them. I mean, I was, when they came through on Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, I mean, we waited in line in a parking lot outside of like, Marlboro Mall in Northeast Calgary, slept overnight. My mom slept in the minivan, making sure we weren't like murdered or kidnapped. And like, we got tickets, and then I hysterically cried and begged my mom to let me also go to Vancouver, which was a flight. I had to fly. And I went with my friend Shannon Gillette, who was also a big Pumpkins fan. We were the biggest, arguably, Pumpkin fans in our group of friends. And we saved up our money, and my dad took us, and we flew to Vancouver after school.
I was there too. She's excluded me from the story, but I also...
You did not come to Vancouver.
Yeah, I sure did.
No way.
See? It's kind of insane, actually, that she totally just wrote me out. I guess this is what life when Sarah writes me out. Yeah, in fact, I...
Did you have to share a bed with Dad? Because I definitely shared a bed with Shannon.
I did. I shared a bed with Dad, and I...
just mixed you two up.
I was so excited. I was also part of the campaign to go see Smashing Pumpkins in Vancouver. In fact, I called the Greyhound and asked what the tickets were because my mom said she wasn't going to. But Sarah just omitted that fact. But,
I don't remember you there, but that's fine. It's cool. The Pumpkins were a big, that was my biggest band when I was in middle school and high school, for sure.
Well, I mean, what were you listening to before the Smashing Pumpkins? Like, this was the 90s, obviously, right?
All the usual stuff that you would think. Like, we were totally alternative kids who had been influenced by our parents. So we listened to anything they listened to. So the obvious stuff, like, of course, like Prince. Don't have to be beautiful to tell me all. And Bowie. And then we had also, when we were little kids, we'd listen to our parents' music, but then sort of got caught up in the propaganda of like New Kids on the Block. So I remember we wanted all the New Kids on the Block stuff, and my parents were sort of like, okay.
Although apparently our first real obsession was Phil Collins. Yeah, which was going to be the song that I said that had a profound effect on me. But I remember laying in my waterbed because it was the 80s, so we had waterbeds. And Sarah and I never shared a room. We always had our own rooms. And so we had our own giant waterbeds, like tiny. Like there's crazy photos of us where we're like 2 years old and we're laying on a waterbed. Like it's kind of, I mean, weird parenting. The 80s were a different time, you know.
Oh, but, yeah.
But I can remember whenever that record came out with Groovy Kind of Love on it, so we were probably 5 years old or 6 years old or something, and I just remember having this profound connection to that music. And as I got a little bit older and had my own little tape recorder in my room, I can remember laying in bed and listening to Groovy Kind of Love and imagining myself singing it. When I'm feeling blue, all I have to do is take a look at you, then I'm not so. Was probably one of the earliest memories I have of wanting to be a singer. Although I never would have said that out loud, and we never were in a band until we were much older, but I can remember something about the melody, which actually is why I don't feel embarrassed about becoming a New Kids on the Block fan, because I think like they had really strong melody. First time was a great time, second time was a blast, third time I fell in love, now I hope it lasts. I can see it in. As a little kid, that's what you attach to. I mean, that's the only explanation for why little kids listen to Tegan and Sarah. I mean, like, we're singing about really, really dark stuff, like really deep stuff, emotional stuff, oftentimes intimate stuff, and yet there's all these little kids dancing and singing, and they're attaching to something totally different. They're not listening to the content. I had no idea what Groovy Kind of Love was about.
Do you listen to lyrics now, or do you hear melodies first and it takes you a while to get into
melody
lyrics?
First, always, yeah.
Right on.
Yeah, production and melodies, I think lyrics are important, but if a lyric doesn't resonate with me and I love the melody, I'll just rewrite the lyric in my head and sing it wrong each time.
What about you, Sarah? How do you approach it? Like, do you hear lyrics or melodies?
I don't know if I even know. I feel like I hear everything really kind of mixed up in my brain. A lot of times it's not just melody. It is something about a combination of melody, counter melody, and lyrics. Like, there's something about the way someone's singing a certain string of syllables that I'll become really drawn to. Like, I really like that
Nick Jonas song Jealous. It's probably one of his biggest hits, and there's just something about the way those blocks of words and melody come together that I don't know, there's actually something very satisfying and mathematical about it in my brain, and I really sort of feel like that's always what I'm striving to do when I'm marrying lyrics and melodies together.
It's like fit the equation together so that it all equals something like...
Yeah, you can, I mean, writing a hooky melody is only really part of it. You know, I think what sort of elevates something to the status where people want to hear it over and over again, or it becomes addictive, like an earworm. I don't think it's just a melody. I think it's a combination of what other melodies are in there, and then what words and sort of, what syllables, like how you're lumping things together in your brain. It sort of becomes almost sugary and exciting, and you want to hear it over and over and over again.
Was that kind of the thing? Do you think that's what happened when you heard Siamese Dream? Like, it all kind of came together?
I know, speaking from my own experience with Smashing Pumpkins, because, I mean, I also was a massive fan. I'm not crazy obsessive like Sarah was, but there was something specific about that record, like, that I think it's probably because of the age that it came into our lives, and because it was one of the first records and bands that we became obsessed with that wasn't our parents' music, that there is something about the drums and the guitars that was so unique and different for that time, but also for our ears, like what we had been listening to, like Tom Cochran. Bruce Springsteen, like we were really in the like rock stage when that came out in our household, and I think there was just, it wasn't just what Billy was saying, you know, or his image, which may not have even been relatable at the time. It was the music, it was the idea, it was the concept, it was everything. Also, too, it's probably the first time developmentally, like, because I was just on the precipice of becoming a teenager, it was probably the first time I'd listened to music and desiring, even subconsciously, hearing conflict in a way that represented me. So, you know, when I was younger, I was probably listening to lots of crazy, you know, music with lots of conflict in it, but I was like 7, so I don't know. I didn't know what anything was. I didn't know what was really happening. But it was the first time I consciously was interested in the conflict of the music and the lyrics and the sentiment, and it represented me. I didn't know that. I couldn't have verbalized that at the time, but I certainly can articulate it now. Like, I was just about to become very moody and a very secretive, confused, conflicted teenager. And
our teenage years coincided with the grunge era. So
yeah,
it was perfect,
like, most
timing.
Most kids have to find something to sort of express themselves when they're a part of a world that, you know, in their imaginations don't at all represent them. And it was like Billy Corgan became what represented me and my conflict.
One big.
Well, I remember when the video came out, us sitting in the office downstairs and like, just there was just something so adolescent and rebellious about the imagery too, like all the videos
It's interesting though, because you say that, because I was gonna say, like, the other big artist that we loved around that time, obviously Nirvana. And Hole. And I remember both of those bands, I loved them, but they were, in my opinion, like, visually, musically, they were really messy. I mean, they were very, to me, the thing that drew me to Smashing Pumpkins, and this is really true about my personality and my sort of character, is that I'm buttoned up. I'm a Virgo. I really struggle to express my emotions, and I'm more cerebral, and I had a very disciplined teenage bedroom. Like, it was like everything had to be organized. I had to make my bed, everything had to be like put away, and there was something very anal retentive about Smashing Pumpkins. Billy was a bit of a, like, I was about to say tyrant, but he was a very strong particular leader, and he had a very strong aesthetic for every single record, and it was like the videos, I know he had his hand in, and I really identified with that as a teenager, whereas I loved Nirvana and Courtney Love, but I didn't necessarily identify with Kurt Cobain or Courtney Love because they seemed like out of control. And I Billy seemed the opposite. He seemed very much in control.
Like he was angry, but he was in control about.
Yeah, there was an intelligence for me that I picked up, like his lyrics and his sort of. Yeah, there was something about him that really read to me as like being, of course, like angsty and difficult and ornery and whatever. But there was also something very controlled about that, which seemed very powerful to me.
It's like finding a kindred soul out there.
At the time, I certainly felt like that. Yeah.
So when you guys started making music together, I mean, by the time you started making music together, were you kind of beyond Smashing Pumpkins? Were you beyond all this?
Yeah.
Or
no, no. Well, because we started in 10th grade writing songs. Okay. So I definitely still, for sure. I think that what's interesting to me is that the early output, it sounds nothing like a lot of the bands that we were listening to. Mm-hmm. But I just think that was probably some lack of skill and like understanding of how the instruments we had worked. So the only thing I really hear when I listen back to that stuff that in any way resembles or shares any sort of DNA with the band or the songwriters we are now is our voices. If I gave you my number, would it still be the same? You can hear how we're using very similar songwriting lyrical patterns that we still use to this day. And I think probably a lot of that comes from very early childhood. I think I find more probably in common with what my parents were listening to and when we were really young and probably how we were influenced by that kind of songwriting. So we didn't sound like, no one would have been like, boy, you sound like Smashing Pumpkins. I almost feel like that becomes more of an aesthetic, sonic choice when you are like, we're going to start a band and it's going to sound like our favorite band, the Smashing Pumpkins and New Order or something. We never did that. We were just like, whoa, we just wrote a song. Listen, like it was sort of like a bit like intuitive and there wasn't as much of a sonic connection to like the stuff that was probably being played in our rooms like 24 hours a day.
But also we were at that point in our lives starting to really understand that we were queer. And I think music became a place for us to explore some of the feelings that we were having and probably a lot of the things that we wanted to say. You know, like there's a lot of passion that goes into performing, right? A lot of adrenaline and excitement. And I think that it became a part of like the way that listening and embodying and loving and being passionate about music and those other bands, it became our way to explore our passion and identity for ourselves was through music, which is why I hated basically the first 5 years of our career, because every journalist would be like, it's like they tore a page out of their diary. It's like, you know, and I just thought it was so sexist that they would talk about us that way. But now I look back on it and I'm like, oh, we were pouring our, I mean, we still pour our hearts into it, but there's a craft, right? We're like, we're exploring melodies and counter melodies and how to say this thing, but say it in a different way than we ever have before. And like, it's about story and about digging into an experience that you've had and you've now had 5 years of perspective. Like songwriting is so much more complicated now. Whereas in that early part of our career, we were truly just saying exactly how we felt in that moment, exactly like this thing that we had to get out of us. You know, there was just this like incredible intensity. You know? I hope I never figure out who broke your heart. And if I do,
although it seems like with this new project, this is the most like open that you have been about sexuality and identity and gender. Mm-hmm. I mean, what was it about this record or like this time?
I mean, I think identity is probably a topic that a lot of artists, not just musicians, but just a lot of people are talking about right now. And that sort of probably is a mirror of what's happening in the social conversation across TV and film and, you know, politically. And so I don't know that it's something that I didn't do on purpose in the past. In fact, I felt like
in a lot of ways, Tegan and I somewhat muted ourselves in terms of our sexuality and our identity because we felt there were such negative repercussions in the early parts of our career. I mean, Tegan said about people, this even just an innocuous thing like, oh, a page torn from their diary. I mean, that's like so, it's so sexist. And it, you know, or there was almost a displeasure in how negative our music was. Like, you know, male reviewers being like, almost implying like there was a discomfort about like, why are they so upset all the time and angry all the time? And there's a desire, I think, for people to experience women as pleasurable and easy and
smile,
you know, and if you're going to be upset, smile while you're upset, would ya? Like, why do you gotta be so loud and gruff with your ugly girl voice, you know, like stop. And so I think, you know, Tegan and I were strategic in terms of how we approached our messaging. And when it felt like we were being cornered and sort of interrogated about our identity, there was a natural reflex to sort of say like, I don't want to talk about this. Why do I have to talk about this? We are out. We're gay. Who cares? You know, like, I don't want to have to discuss it. But now there's a sort of my new reflex is to be like, why can't I discuss it? It's interesting. It's identity is everything, religious, racial, whatever it is. Like, we should be allowed to talk about ourselves without apologizing to the majority that doesn't look or act or behave like us. And in my sort of mid-30s right now, I almost feel a rebellion coming in my the way that I sort of talk to people and the way that I act. I don't want to be normal. I don't want to get married. I don't care that I might not be with the same person for the rest of my life. I don't want to be heterosexual. I don't want to believe that to be normal and to be accepted and have the same rights as other people that I have to be like other people all the time. And I think probably all of that, you know, was what, you know, made me start thinking, oh, I want to write a song that's sort of political about gender and identity, but it's also just pop. You treat me like your boyfriend and trust me like a very best friend. Kiss me like your boyfriend. You call me up like you want your best friend. You turn me on like you want your boyfriend, but I don't want to be your secret anymore. Or I want to write a song that's kind of a love song to my girlfriend, but is also sort of a, you know, an acknowledgement that as much as I cared about participating in and being an activist with the same-sex movement for marriage, I don't want to get married, and here's why. But I think right now, for a lot of different kinds of people, there is a bit of a like, hey, this space has been very specifically straight, heteronormative, whatever, white, male for a long time. And even in our organization, it has been. Like, the majority of the people who have worked in substantial positions with us for the last 17 years, whether it be our agents, our managers, people at the record label, are white, straight guys. And Tegan and I have, you know, we've railed against that for a long time, whether it was at festivals or on radio or whatever. But at some point, we just looked inward and said, like, geez, how are we supposed to ask and demand that the industry change if we don't seem to be able to represent the change that we are asking for? And so, you know, we've done a lot more in the last, you know, two album cycles to make sure that we are hiring a more diverse group of people, really actively looking for women, for example, to fill positions that never, you know, have been, like, have always been just dudes, like, all the, our front of house, our lighting, our stage techs, our tour manager, our production manager. We are trying to fill those positions with women because we are trying to, I guess, like, live the example we hope other people will, you know, maybe open their minds to.
You know, to your original question, like, about why we feel comfortable to do it now, I think it was very political for us. It was a game, like, early on in our career. I think we felt, as Sarah, to borrow from what Sarah said, when we felt cornered to talk about our sexuality or our gender or, you know, homophobia or sexism in the industry, I was like, this is, you're going to reveal that and then no one's going to want us at the party. So we kind of would reject talking about it, then get invited to the party and then talk nonstop about homophobia and misogyny in the industry. You know, it was like, so for us, it was sort of like, it was a game, you know, we wanted to be here. We wanted to be represented and the world wasn't ready for that yet. And so we had to sort of, we had to kind of slalom through a lot of obstacles and now it's a lot easier, but it's still there. I mean, the world has not changed. You know, I love that people keep saying how much, you know, progress has been made. And we get asked by journalists all the time, what are you going to do now that marriage equality happened? And it's like, well, yeah, we got marriage equality, which is awesome. Like, I mean, that's great. And it was huge and it was monumental and no one thought it was going to happen. And it's incredible, but it's also something predominantly within our community that white people want, that privileged people want, that, you know, a certain type of people want. And like, that's not the end. Like, you know, there's just so much more work to be done. And I hate this idea that in the mainstream, we think the fight is over.
It's an important part of being educated or activated in any way about any cause. Tegan and I have leaned on people. We have asked for the support of so many people in order to accomplish certain things. And it would be devastating to me to think that we would stop now. It should be what's required of all of us, that we continue to say, look, yeah, things are fine for me and Tegan. Tegan and I do just fine. We're successful. Mm-hmm. We can sort of roll through life a little untouched right now by some of the things that are impacting people on a daily basis. And I think if your life is comfortable and easy, then you are in the perfect position to lend some of that privilege and power to other people and fight on their behalf or with them. Maybe I just feel more motivated now in, you know, in later on in our career. But I just think to myself, like, what are we doing? What would we be doing up here if we were just singing dumb songs that didn't have any meaning, or we weren't leading lives that had meaning? I just feel like it's the only way I can balance the idea that Tegan and I are like these dancing clowns. Like, I'm just like, we have to do something of substance. Like, we have to. Tell you that I love you, that I can't hold back. The feeling that you give me, wanna give it right back. I know you always win at this particular game. If you want me to play.
And this is Boyfriend from Tegan and Sarah's 2016 record, Love You to Death. Sisters, man, they are the best, as is music. So sisters and music together are like the absolute best. And hey, if you have a story about a song or a musical experience that changed your life, we here at Team This Song, we'd love to hear it. We're putting together an episode of listener stories, and we've been getting submissions, which is super exciting. Just record your story to a voice memo and email it to us. thissong@kutx.org is our email address. Your story might make it into the episode. And just in case you need more Tegan and Sarah goodness, I will post a link to their Studio and A session on the show notes page for this episode at kutx.org, along with a Spotify playlist of all the songs we referenced in this podcast, so you can hear all the songs all the way through. And that's it. You have come to the end of another episode of This Song. This Song is a production of KUTX 98.9 in Austin, Texas. This episode was produced by David Sanger and me, Elizabeth McQueen, with help from Jackie Fuller, Peter Babb, Deidre Gott, and Catherine McQueen, who is my awesome sister. This interview was recorded by Cliff Hargrove. Kelly Seal is our excellent intern, and thanks to Deidre Gott and Peter Babb and Todd Callahan for all they do for this podcast. And yes, it's true. Our theme song is Mahout by Austin's own Hard Proof. Right on. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.